All right, well, I've got some good news and some bad news. Good news is a lot of what I want to talk about, I think Bruce said better than I would say it, and Mark certainly said a lot of it, certainly the economic issues, a lot better than I would say it. So I'm going to be able to skip a lot of my slides. The bad news is a lot of what folks said triggered some other ideas that I want to touch on, particularly what Ken was talking about, as well as what Mark was talking about. So, for me, it's always really fascinating to hear what people who preceded me at the FCC have to say about their experiences and to hear what those currently at the FCC have to say about their experiences. I like to think I fit in this nice little sweet spot where the FCC actually believed in creating competition.
Do you have a laptop in?
Sorry, who is speaking?
Who is this?
Yes, who are you?
I'm Jonathan Askin. I'm a professor at Brooklyn Law School. And I was at the FCC from 1997 to 1999. I teach telecom law, technology law, and I run something at Brooklyn Law School called the Brooklyn Law Incubator and Policy Clinic. And we represent a lot of internet technology startups. We also do some policy advocacy still for emerging companies. All right, so let me talk about what I heard from Ken. And Ken, I may mischaracterize what I think the FCC was like during your tenure there. When I came in 1997, I came right after the Telecom Act, and I came because of the Telecom Act. I came because we had a mandate. I was a civil rights attorney until 1996, and I thought I was working on the great issue of the day. I was monumentally bored with civil rights, civil liberties law, because all of the great issues had been fought in the 60s, and everything I was doing was essentially retrenchment, 40 years after the fact, trying to preserve the line of scrimmage that the early civil rights and civil liberties advocates had staked out. So when the Telecom Act passed, I took that as sort of marching orders and an opportunity for young lawyers to change the law in a profound way and in a way in which lawyers haven't really had the opportunity to do very often in the 200-plus year history of the country. You know, maybe the Civil Rights Act of 63. Maybe radical Reconstruction, maybe 1787, the constitutional battles. But for me, 1996 was sort of a profound moment when young lawyers could actually create new law where nothing existed, create competition where a monopoly environment existed before. I was a bit naive. It sounds like Ken was a bit naive, too, in his assessment of his period when he thought he was injecting or trying to fight the Bell establishment. During and pre and post divestiture. So for me, it was, and I saw, and I don't mean this to cast aspersions on the people that preceded me at the FCC, but I thought there was a real distinction between the people who came to the FCC, who were at the FCC before 1996, and the people that Reed Hunt brought in to implement the Telecom Act after 1996. I thought, in my mind, there was this old sort of bureaucratic civil servant mindset. Do the bidding of the Bells. Apparently, that certainly was not the case with Ken and his peers up until 1985. But it certainly was the feeling I had. And I feel like the folks who were at the FCC circa 1996, who had been there for years before, looked at us with sort of a bit aghast that we thought we were going to come in and try to change the world and try to implement the Telecom Act of 96 and inject competition. And I remember, I think, first of all, is anyone here an ILEC advocate? So we're all sort of in the right.
If they do good things, I'm on their side.
I have many as clients.
Is anyone here from the cable industry? Do we all represent some sort of competitive force at this point? This is sort of the inside baseball here. This is more of a party meeting. This is a party meeting.
Wait a second, excuse me. All the people that are on the webcast are all from the phone companies, please.
All right. Can't see. It would be nice if we had one insurgent, from the side of the incumbents trying to respond to. Unless this is really just an organizing meeting, and I assume that's what tomorrow is about more than anything else. Right? Okay. Good. Here I am. Here's my slides. Excellent. All right. So I'm actually just only going to talk about a couple slides. I'm going to talk very briefly about the past 500 years. of,
and then there was the internet.
Yeah.
Right. There they go.
All right. This is the way I see the current state of affairs right now. 500 years ago, we had essentially no law. We had feudal society and the emergence of early conceptions of common law. Property law, torts law, and contracts law, pretty much in that order, became the universe and the way in which we governed all interactions between human beings. Property law, obviously, was the first because the feudal lords needed control over their property. And then when the bourgeoisie emerged, we had needed the emergence for inter-party contractual relations. And then torts law, obviously, to govern potential problems between citizens. Now, the piece that emerged, through the emergence of canals, public transport, public houses, is common carriage. I think we're all pretty familiar. We're all pretty sophisticated in this crowd. We all are relatively familiar with the evolution of common carriage. 19th century, you have the emergence of statutory law, designed to fill the gaps where traditional principles of common law were largely insufficient. And for me, the big one here, the one that's relevant here, is the emergence of antitrust law, a way to combat excessively large corporate power relative to that might encroach upon the public good or the rights of citizens. And then obviously in the past 100 years, we've seen the emergence of various regulatory bodies, because the statutory laws were largely insufficient to deal with specific niches. And in telecommunications, we've seen it in primarily two areas. We've seen it in maybe three areas. We've seen it at the state level through the utility commissions, and we've seen it at the federal level through the Federal Communications Commission. Now, this is something I don't need to talk about. I do think we're at a bizarre inflection point where the laws don't necessarily, where we need some new structuring of the laws to deal with what the global internet might and digital technology might impose and change the paradigm pretty dramatically. But right now we're living in a world where, the way I see it, we've lost the conception of common carriage. Over the past 10 years, regulators have largely conflated the conception of common carriage and confused it with the statutory concept of antitrust. So we've lost the common, the traditional common law principle, the traditional regulatory principle of common carriage, and have replaced it with the conception of antitrust. And now regulators are largely using conceptions of antitrust in the absence of imposing common carriage regulation. That, I think, is the crux of the problem that we are living in right now. Because it becomes very, and frankly, in addition to that, we've also lost the antitrust hook. Did everyone see last week the Supreme Court decision in SBC versus Linkline? It's sort of the last in a long line of three Supreme Court cases that have largely said that the antitrust laws do not apply in the world of telecommunications because we've got this complex system of regulatory relations and we are better served by a regulatory body, and lay juries and lay judges are not well equipped to deal with something that is best left to the hands of expert agencies. So we're now living in a world where the antitrust laws don't apply to telecom, and we no longer have a complex regulatory regime that applies to telecom. And that's in part primarily because over the past 10 years or so, regulators have abandoned the concept of common carriage. And what do I mean by that? It grows out of Mark Cooper's discussion of the AT&T v. The Portland case. The case that said ultimately when it wound its way up to the Supreme Court that cable modems are not telecom services subject to common carrier oversight. Well, the FCC took that as marching orders to build a level playing field between phone lines, cable lines, and now every other pipe, wireless or otherwise, capable of delivering any connectivity to the internet. And they said, if you are providing broadband services, it doesn't matter that those broadband services are being used for a service that might arguably be regulated as a common carrier service, you are no longer going to be construed as a common carrier. You are free of government regulation. You're free of the 100 plus years of authority that the regulators have built up surrounding the use of those facilities for common carrier services. So now we're living in a world where, regardless of what access pipe you're using, be it a phone line, be it a cable line, be it a wireless line, be it someday broadband over power line, there are no common carrier rules that apply to you. The only rules that we think apply are twofold. One is potential implementation of antitrust law, so that the FCC does not have that authority anymore. It's dubious whether or not the Federal Trade Commission has that authority at this point. So what we're left with, essentially, is a world in which regulators are now desperate to figure out how to impose the public, historic public policy obligations onto facilities that are no longer regulated as common carriers. So what does that mean? And I forget who invoked the early VoIP E911 issues. ISP planet guy.
Alex,
yeah. We're now living in a world, and we've seen this over the past 4 or 5 years or so, and it's basically been a domino effect. Because the FCC no longer has the authority to impose common carrier regulations on voice services or video services or other services delivered over a broadband pipe, we're left in a world where only the narrowband delivery of a voice service or the historic broadcast or a cable delivery service of its traditional service, the video service, are regulated pursuant to their respective FCC rules and statutes. So video, but by and large, it means that the delivery of any other service is no longer regulated, except now the FCC is trying to figure out how to impose some sort of authority and impose the public, promote the public good upon the services that are now being delivered over these broadband pipes. So what has the FCC done? In the VoIP context, it's essentially said, we're not going to regulate the broadband pipes, we're not going to impose E911 obligations on the broadband pipes that are delivering, that are necessary for delivery of an emergency response service. We're not going to impose the Disabilities Act requirements on the broadband pipe used to deliver services that might be accessed by someone with disabilities. We're not going to impose restrictions on the broadband pipes used to for lawful intercept purposes. Instead, we are going to point to the application that's delivered over the open internet that now seems to be replicating what was a traditional service. So in the realm of E911, you see Verizon not being regulated as a pipe provider and Comcast not being regulated as a pipe provider, but you see whoever is delivering the service, the voice service, over those respective pipes being the entity that now the government is pointing to say you are now the regulated entity. So what I think happened is we played essentially a definitional shell game over the past 10 years in which those that historically should have been regulated, either pursuant to common carrier and arguably pursuant to antitrust laws, and certainly pursuant to Title II of the Telecommunications Act, are no longer regulated, and the FCC has been forced to find those entities that it can now turn to impose those regulations. And those are essentially the disintermediated, unaffiliated services that are delivered over the open internet. And to me, that gets the whole regulatory regime completely backwards. And that's the piece that I want to focus on, I think, as we go forward and if this community evolves and starts engaging in discussions. I don't know that I need much more to say than that. I had obviously a whole long discussion about 1984, 1996, 2008, and the future. The parties have changed a little bit. You know, so when I went to the FCC, it was 1996. The big battles were brewing between ILECs and CLECs. That was it. You know, everyone was lining up on one side or the other. At that point, cable companies were largely pretending to be CLECs, pretending to be new insurgent competitors, and largely helping the insurgent CLECs. We also had, at the time, a couple deep pockets in the form of AT&T, the then recovering monopolist, that little middle period when it was neither the Bell monopoly nor the largest incumbent phone company in America once again. So we had we could prevail upon the deep pockets of AT&T to finance the competitive movement. When ultimately we lost AT&T to SBC and we lost MCI to Verizon, the competitive industry was actually in a financial quandary. They had no deep pockets left upon which to seek to fight that competitive battle. I think that was a big, big problem for the competitive industry, the loss of the deep-pocketed financer for the regulatory and litigation battles that I don't think people fully appreciate. Now we're living in a world where the competitors are a little bit different, but the battles are somewhat similar. Instead of calling it unbundling, we're now calling it net neutrality or something. And the players are a little bit different. No longer is our deep pocket AT&T/MCI. Our deep pocket is now Google/maybe Yahoo and Microsoft to some extent to ensure an open internet. Now, that's perhaps as tenuous a relationship as we had with AT&T historically. I was one of the people who was particularly concerned last year during the 700 megahertz auction and the threat that, in fact, Google might be a winner of the 700 megahertz auction. I know a lot of people thought it would have been a good thing if Google could get this pipe and keep it open. My concern was without Google being in the same situation as every other internet application provider, with us being beholden to an intervening gatekeeper, be it Verizon or Comcast or some wireless access provider, without Google as our deep pocket, we were going to lose Google and lose the battle, the net neutrality battle, in the same way that we lost the CLEC battle once we lost AT&T and MCI. Yeah, I think I may have had AOL and Time Warner as the other analogy here somewhere, yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I was at the FCC during the AOL-Time Warner merger, and I had a friend at AOL who, along with CFA, was one of the biggest exponents of open access at the time. Cable platform had to be an open platform. Their tune changed the moment that Time Warner announced the proposed merger. And they tried to justify it, and I think they convinced their employees that, in fact, it was justified. I don't know that I need to go through any of my other slides. I know we're running behind on time. Oh, I want to do a little segue into David. Dave, you're up next, right?
That's correct. Yes, you're in charge.
He's up next, yeah? All right, good. Because and I don't know what Dave's plan is, but... over the past couple of weeks, I was looking at the various charts on broadband deployment around the world and who's right. You know, the RAND report, the OECD report, the ITIF just put out a report. I want to know if Dave can maybe add some clarity to some of that, because here's what I got.
Saul Hansel retracted.
What was his statement? What did he say?
He was the one in the Times who said maybe the U.S. is number one, because Len Wayne had one of these reports.
Yeah, because of the ITF. Okay, so RAND or something. So all right. Here, I think everyone universally acknowledges that on some measure we are somewhere around 15th in the world in broadband penetration. Some say maybe lower, depending on how you calculate broadband. But at best, we're somewhere around 15 in broadband penetration. Right. All right. That's an accurate one enough. All right. Connectivity scorecard. This was the one that came. This was a study I saw about a week ago, maybe even less, from some. Folks at Calgary Business School. They say we are apparently number one in connectivity. And that means our ability to actually use the internet for productivity gains in business. That may or may not be true, and it doesn't get to the heart of residential broadband. But if we're all at businesses, does it really matter if we don't have good access to broadband at home to the same extent that they've got in other countries? So I don't know if Dave is familiar with this study or not. I'd love to get some clarity. Okay, good. And then there is... this study that just came out last week, also from the...
Oh, you shouldn't show that anything from those guys in public.
I want a response. I want to understand it then. What?
They have so many bloody errors in everything that comes out of ITIF. So not merely is their money tainted, but their work is utter garbage. Go back to the previous one. Lieberman is
I'm happy to leave this up here because I actually want an explanation on this one. I want to know why... This I thought you'd actually agree with.
I haven't even looked at it. As soon as I go to his footnotes, and they say the exact opposite of what's in his charts.
This is the conclusion I derived from it, and I thought it might be a conclusion that Dave might probably agree with, and that's this is our innovation index, essentially. It says that while we are, at this point, sixth in our ability to use technology for business purposes and innovation, we are rapidly declining. We're apparently 40th in our ability going forward to use to create a new generation capable of innovating over our networks. And if anyone's seen that study, I'd love to get some clarity on it, because that study was particularly disturbing to me. These are the studies they use. I had a lot on Obama. I was chair of Barack Obama's Internet Governance Committee, so I have some good feelings about what Obama might be doing at the new FCC, and Julius might be doing at the new FCC, and what the folks at NTIA might be doing with broadband deployment. But this is the world I think we've been living in. I want to leave you with that. Everyone remember Dr. Seuss? I just love bringing up this trend. This is the world essentially where every single carrier is so stubborn they refuse to budge until everyone essentially dies, and the world does not grow up around them. But we're all standing still, butting heads, regulators in industry, industry in industry, consumers in industry, and we end up getting nowhere. My hope is that through discussions like this, we can actually step to the side a little bit and move around the northbound tax, perhaps. Dave?
I'm not sure quite what I'm doing here, because I'm probably going to say all the wrong things, and I discover I'm disagreeing with the people I respect most, starting with Mark Cooper, and maybe even Jonathan. Although what I really want from Jonathan is the answer of, how does Jules, who we both respect, we both know is smart, and we believe is honest and trying to do the right thing, get things right? And the question that's most interesting to me, beyond what waste is in the stimulus, is what is Jules likely to do wrong? Because people like Jonathan, who are brilliant, imaginative, and creative, and Blair Levin, and Kevin Warbeck, and Susan Crawford, and Bill Kennard, all of whom are great, wonderful people I have enormous respect for, they're probably all smarter than I am, may be getting wrong. I now have to speak truth to power when my friends are in power. And that's hard. Okay, Mark had to run. I'm sorry he's not here. Oh, there you are.
I'm watching you.
Okay. Mark, let me apologize to anything that suggested I have anything other than enormous respect for you and what you're doing, your ability, and your dedication. On the other hand, what he said is almost certainly wrong. Okay? Everywhere in the world where people could get more than 5 megabits, they chose to get more than 5 megabits. That happened in France. That happened in Japan. That happened in the United States, where the cable companies were killing the telcos because the telcos had 3 meg DSL. And when the cable companies went to 10 meg, that was enough, and the cable companies are going to 50. So that whether or not you have a logical discussion of whether 5 meg is enough for people, in fact, if you have Verizon with 200 meg, as they will have in almost all of New York in the next few years, and Time Warner with 50 meg, as they almost certainly will have in almost all of New York in maybe 3-4 years, they're all the way behind, I sure as hell wouldn't want to be in business selling 5 meg and expect to get any customers from the two of them. So the notion that that's a world that we can play in, well, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a theoretician, I'm not an academic, I got to deal with the real world, and that's what I look at. The other thing I wanted to say, in fact, my opening was going to be about Mark and Bruce. I think Mark knows this, I don't think Bruce knows this. And I don't think anybody outside the circles of everybody who knows each other in policy realizes this. They happen to be significant power brokers now. Right now,
this
Mark... This Bruce, who Kevin Martin had a nice meeting with and talked about how much he had learned from Bruce's work, okay, now has a whole regime of people who want to read Bruce's work, want to believe it, and will take whatever he says seriously in a way that never happened before. Even more to the point is Mark... No, it's happening. It's down in Washington. Mark, what's happening in Washington is a total change. People like Mark and Gigi Sohn and... Who's the group now?
Oh, I see.
Mark, who's the best people not going into government right now in D.C. in this stuff? You, Gigi?
Public interest advocates can't go into government because they are registered lobbyists.
Fine, but they're putting loads of unregistered lobbyists into government. I've got 3 more that are coming into the Obama regime right now. And the other has a cousin and father who's a lobbyist or politician. But yeah, they don't let in registered lobbyists. But those folks suddenly are the ones that everybody who's making decisions want to listen to. Now, there are people who are far better than Mark and Gigi, much less me, at persuading people to do what they want. They're Tom Palki and Jim Ciccone and the lobbyists, who are the best bloody persuaders in the world. I learned an enormous amount watching from them, and they try to undermine everything that Mark is doing that doesn't happen to go their way, and we're going to have the battle. So that's why it gets interesting. But they're in the middle of it. And some of you who don't know Jonathan, Jonathan won what's probably the most interesting case in telecom in the last 10 years. He was the Pulver decision that made VoIP almost acceptable. Turned out VoIP didn't particularly matter, and we're all very disillusioned with what we spent years on. But
and what are the unintended negative consequences of the Pulver order?
And let's not go there because I have some things that people haven't heard before. and might even surprise you. Okay. How many of you folks think the main goal of policy in this business is great services affordable to everyone? I would think I'd get a lot of hands on that. That sure sounds good to me. And that's where I'm going. Let me broaden that a little bit. What?
Think it or read it as stated.
I can change the words, but what I'm trying to say is that the goal of public policy is that you, me, and poor people, and rural people, and everybody has something that's really great in all the stuff we're dealing with, whether it be a great internet, affordable phones, and so on.
The statute says adequate
facilities. I don't give a damn what the statute says.
But that's for public policy. Adequate facilities at reasonable charges.
So that sounds really good to me. And let me give you a broader way for you folks who didn't want to raise your hands then. I don't think many people are going to disagree with this statement, which is in the coming Hawaii statute, so I'm calling it the Hawaii principle, but half the people in this room have said the same thing in different ways. The services in our state should be comparable to the best countries in the world. And specifically, the guy who put that together talked about 100 megabits for about $30 and listed the countries where you can get that.
Is that Bruce?
What? No, that's not Bruce. That's actually somebody none of us ever heard of in Hawaii. But the idea, now obviously we can't all be above average, but we can be close. And that to me sounds like a pretty good goal of what we want to have. Does that, nobody wants to raise their hand, so let me ask the opposite. How many people think that that's not a pretty good goal, that the U.S. should be comparable to the more advanced countries?
At least.
Okay.
All of you.
Now, hard stop. This is where I'm getting in trouble with. I go back to the folks who are intellectually important now, the folks that Jonathan worked with. There's a great paper on Kevin Warbach from 1997 saying this is what we believe. Pepper signed off on it, and Kennard, I'm sure, believed in it then, and we know better. And turns out to be total bullshit, unfortunately, when we look back over 10 years. And it's not because it wasn't the best people in the world trying to find the best answer. It's we had 10 more years of experience and so on. How many people in this room believe that the way to go forward in this industry, and I'm looking at a couple of people, is to have more competition?
Competition on top of a regulated wire.
That's right. Okay. Now, what I'm looking at is that most of the people who really know what's going on outside of policy circles are absolutely certain that we are going to have more consolidation and less competition going forward. Okay? This is a real problem. Kevin was on the transition team. He's a friend, and we've talked about this, and Blair and I have talked about this. Trying to figure out, well, competition didn't work here, and for lots of reasons I can go into, probably won't, at least in landline, and even in wireless, where they're going to double the spectrum, do all kinds of great things, cognitive radio and so on, to let stuff in. It may be that Verizon and AT&T are so far ahead that nobody would ever catch up. Clearwire is facing bankruptcy, and Sprint. And that's the world I come from. When I ask to Wall Street or Ivan Seidenberg or almost anybody who's not in policy, they think we're going to have less competition going forward, not now. So that leads to the question I keep answering, which I don't have the answer to, is what's the smart move if, in fact, we're not going to have more competition and we're going to be stuck with the duopoly and some kind of wireless going against it?
Enforcement of regulation. And AstroTurf being forced to shut the hell up.
And I would love that, and I hate the AstroTurf, and I just called down a friend of mine for using some stuff from one of the most obnoxious AstroTurf organizations in Washington, although he hides it pretty well, but they're like really incompetent. He just doesn't know what he's doing, talking about. Give me a good Verizon lobbyist like David Young before you give me Atkinson. Oh, quickly on what happened in there. The Waverman studies did not say that we are fine in broadband. In fact, when you read the study, as opposed to the write-up in the summary, it pointed out that the U.S. was far behind in infrastructure. We were ahead in things like how many people use software, how many schools and libraries are connected, because people Jonathan worked with in 1996 got that in the act, and almost every school and library in the U.S. is connected now. And that was what they call connectivity. And people got really confused because everybody else was talking about broadband. And Waverman may have budged in how he put it, but the data on that's fairly clear. The next week, after Waverman came up with that one, the ITU came up with another study on connectivity just like Waverman, took different set of 25 criteria and put the U.S. number 15 in the connectivity as well. Reality. The U.S. is behind the leaders and better than some. We are probably about in the middle of the pack, however you measure it when you think of it through. It seems terrible to be 15th out of 25, but the difference between 15 and 3 in broadband, which is the one I know, turns out to be very small. It's about 1 year's growth. If Verizon and AT&T brought down their prices by $10 for 3 years, we'd be up close to the top. It's the difference where we are. So it's wildly overrated. This whole broadband gap is something invented by people who don't like the system now, like me, want to say we got to change this god-awful system, like me, and want a nice rhetorical thing that people like Congress folks who don't pay any attention to these things in depth can understand. As in, yes, yeah, Pepper who said. Pepper is the FCC policy and plans for years, and really good guy, although he's wrong on a lot of this. Pepper said, you can't tell anything to a congressman that doesn't fit on a license plate. And that's fair. Okay. So what am I doing about that? Because I don't want to take too much time. Obviously, I could talk forever in this nonsense. I wrote a book or two. Is what I'm calling evidence-based policy. It comes from what they've done in everyday medicine. It's a sophisticated way of saying, what are the facts? Are we sure about them? And do our conclusions come from the facts? And I believe there's going to be a Journal of Evidence-Based Policy and some other things coming, but that's a separate thing. And let me put that in terms to give you two examples. The first is the one that we all know has nothing to do with telecom. About 5 years ago, suddenly everything in medicine was turned upside down because for decades, just about every doctor in the world believed in hormone replacement therapy and giving estrogen, that was going to protect the woman's heart. Some folks actually went back to the data and said, this is not so. They looked at it, and it turned out when they looked at the data, and they had two big studies coming in, it did not have a protective effect on the heart. And as we've all somehow or other seen, most women stop taking hormone replacement therapy. And it actually looks like it's showing up in the mortality rates 5 years later, although it's a little bit too early to tell. There's a revolution happening in medicine that they call evidence-based medicine. It has loads of techniques, publication bites. That Robert Atkinson, the two Robert Atkinsons and ITF, would not be heard of by anybody in this room if it wasn't that he was saying things that people who can give him $4 million want to hear, and they support him. The people, like Bruce, and sometimes like me, who don't happen to always say what the folks with money want to hear, had to really struggle to be heard. And we found ways sometimes, okay? Atkinson happens to be what I'm really mad at, because everybody's quoting him because the reporters don't know any better, and he's as bad as they get. He was, for the last month and a half, putting his main work into getting Verizon a $1 billion subsidy, even if they didn't add a single line to Fios or a single job. This is the Rockefeller 20% tax credit that Saul Hansel's column in the Times probably killed. It went out of the bill at the last minute when the fix was supposed to be in. And Atkinson believes in this. You help, technology is going to solve all our problems. You help the companies, that's the way we make it do. And he just happens to be a fool, a reasonably educated fool, and quite, you know, displayable. And if you don't know what the subject is, people take him seriously. And he would have been somewhere else and ignored if it wasn't that there's $3 or $4 million going into his fake foundation that happens to run out from a lobbying shop, which is AstroTurf. So I hate AstroTurf more, but that's not so interesting. I want to figure out, what do we tell to Jules and Larry and what's Gomez's Anna and so on, who are actually in these positions of power, that we should look. So I'm looking at the evidence and so on. Give you another piece on the evidence because it came up with Jonathan there. One of Jonathan's slides said that the position in 2008 is that you deregulate, or you, what was the one in your 2008, what word did you use? It was about incentives, but I forget which word you used.
Encouraging deployment
by deregulation, i.e. allowing the telcos more power. This turns out, and it almost made it to the Times, I was talking to the Times guy today, and I think he's going to pull it out, to also be total bullshit, and I said it that way. And why do I think that? Because to look at a problem like that, whether you're right, left, Republican or Democrat, it's really good to look at the facts. Okay? The nations which have seen the most investment going to fiber in particular are countries like Japan, France, Korea, now Holland. All of those countries are among the most competitive in the world, with the strongest regulation. They all have four or more competitors, and it turns out that empirically, and there's lots more data on this, it may not be statistically significant, but it's pretty overwhelming, that where they had strong regulation to protect the competitors, 5 years later, we're seeing more investment. And in fact, that was the problem that was wrong with Kevin's paper. The FCC strategy in 1997 was, we won competition, and I say bravo, I just said it was great in France because they had the competition, and that the way to get it was deregulation. That we know is not true, that competitors die anywhere unless there's strong regulation to protect them, which is different from regulation to get decent consumer prices and so on. So there was such a contradiction. If you want competition, you have to accept regulation in some way. Okay, so let me wrap this one up. I do not know what the right thing to do is if we have Time Warner and Verizon both conspiring to keep, without talking, not never talking to each other directly, signaling to each other, and they're very, very good at this. A friend at Time Warner said, oh yeah, we don't have to meet in the back room anymore. We know how to put things out publicly and we all understand what it is. We got really good at that. Okay, and the US price is, I'm finishing. The U.S. price is 50% higher than in France and Japan. It's actually in the high-speed stuff even more extreme right now. That's what it is. That's the problem that I would have been. The things that I'm seeing are measure the results, not the legal theory or not what's in the statute. Are we actually getting something better? Understand Moore's law. The technology is moving, and that turns out that you think about what's going to happen in the next 3 years and work with that, and that's why. For evidence of market power, which everybody here is saying is this terrible thing, and I agree, you don't talk about structure of market and is there potential competition, which is what Jonathan was complaining about, and he's right on target. You see, is there real competition? How do you know? You look at the prices. The prices are going down and are reasonable compared to other countries like us, you probably have some competition working. If the prices here are a lot higher, competition probably isn't working. That isn't perfect, but it turns out to work very well. And this is coming back to where Mark was. If you don't have something like five competitors, make your policy assuming that competition is weak. It's not absent. The reason most people in this room are going to have the choice of 50 and 200 meg in the next few years is that two competitors, Verizon was scared, Cablevision was talking, stealing too many customers, and they decided to build Fios. But for 80% of the country, it wasn't strong enough to inspire the telco to build fiber, and you're going to have a second-rate internet on the telco side. Of course, Britain, which did the structural separation, is now falling badly behind. And France, Japan, Korea, Holland, Switzerland, probably Spain, and Greece. Okay, so when you come back to what I want to do is see that people in my country or whatever place I'm thinking of have really good service at a good price that they can get, and what Mark was throwing at before, which actually is encompassing almost everything Mark was asking for, that people at home on the internet can pretty much do anything they want, certainly anything reasonable, which is net neutrality and a lot more than that. You have to make sure that they can have the connection, they have enough bandwidth and all that stuff. And that's where I'm trying to figure the answers that I don't have.
At the end, at the end of the panel, we've got, I'm going to give myself the same, this sound, just in case anybody's confused. When you hear that little thing, that's the timer, actually. And I'm going to set it for 5 minutes for me. I'm going to try and get through three slides in 5 minutes. First thing is going to take a while is me figuring out how to use a PC. Evan, that's a cue. Okay. I'll introduce myself while this boots up. My name is Joe Plotkin, and I'm from, I work at, my day job is at a small ISP called BWayNet. We're one of the last remaining competitive providers in New York City. And so I'm going to talk about small businesses and then also how we survive so far. Okay. So, 2 minutes on small businesses. For small businesses, broadband has become over the last 10 years, just so you know, we have been at the forefront, at the on the ground, fighting these battles for the last 10 years. We use COVAD, who is our CLEC, that's a competitive local exchange carrier to provide DSL. They wholesale it to us. They aggregate the traffic. They bring it to us. For our small business customers, we have learned that price is not their only criteria. Speed is important. That's not their only criteria either. But they have discovered that connectivity enables their functionality to do business, for their business to operate. They can't operate without broadband. And while they used to be a little more sensitive to price, all you need is one outage for them to call up and go, "Do you know how much I'm losing today?" So when they have a problem, what they really want is help. They want a human. They don't want somebody reading a script. They want somebody who can really intervene. They are also now starting to become far more sophisticated over the last 10 years. Before it was just, we don't use it much. We get email and we surf the web. We do research. Now they are doing more and more complicated applications. They may have a network person who works for the company, or more likely they'll have somebody that comes in once a month or whenever they can't print from Word. They are desperate for more upstream bandwidth, which is a problem based on some of the legacy stuff that we touched on, and a particular peeve of mine since something I stressed 10 years ago. But they're starting to host their own servers, they're doing remote office, they're doing offsite backup and so on. So they're starting to appreciate the extras, the static IPs, the latency, you know, low latency, if they're doing voice over IP, privacy, redundancy, and all these complicated, why has to show. Where am I? Oh, I'm running behind. So that's basically the small business. And those are our customers. As we are a small independent provider, we basically identify with our customers, or more importantly, they identify with us. Because in whatever business they're in, they're fighting against a larger competitor by offering the same sorts of values that we offer in fighting against, in competing against the Verizons and the Roadrunners, which is personal attention, flexibility, knowledge. In our case, specifically in terms of ISPs, we've also emphasized local as opposed to being a national company. And we've got an office in Soho, and so if somebody's router breaks, hey, take a subway, get a router, you'll be back up in an hour instead of waiting 2 days for a truck to show up at your house. After the blackout, when the electricity suddenly came back on, routers blew up all over the place. We had them lined up all day, and our customers were up by that afternoon when the power came back. We innovated. We have offered services like anonymous DSL, so that if the Record Industry Association or the movie industry came to us and said, hey, who had that IP last Tuesday, we could honestly say to them, we don't know. Okay? And a lot of people responded and bought that. And so we have fiercely loyal customers. Our small business customers love us, and they don't leave. I'm going to need one more minute, okay? Okay. Our forecast is cloudy, and then I'm going to show you why. This is actually, I don't have to do much of this because Mark covered a lot of this, and Jonathan covered a lot of it as well. That basically the 96 Act initially created some competition. There were a lot of DSL providers, and they all got decimated because the 96 Act was not enforced. And I make that point really strongly because in that case you're talking about a piece of physical wire that exists in the real world. And they couldn't even enforce that availability of a physical wire that exists in the real world. If you expect the FCC or some other entity, some other regulator, to enforce network neutrality, where interference on something like Skype is 100 milliseconds of latency in the network that you can't even define, it's impossible. It will not happen. They can't find real wires. They're not going to find 100 milliseconds of latency. You launch a new service, the new Skype, whatever it happens to be, you won't even know why people don't use it. To them, it'll just seem crappy. That's the technical term, by the way. One more. So everybody's covered that net neutrality is a market failure, so I don't need to cover that. The reason that that Fios is a problem is because the speed increase is such a jump that we will lose customers. As one of the last competitors, if I was offered Fios, I'd probably take it, right? To get those kinds of speeds over fiber for the prices they're talking about. But they have taken that public communications, telecommunications network and privatized the asset and now are leveraging that to make Fios a closed system, not letting customers like us interconnect, like COBAD and thereby us. And we're one of the few people in the marketplace that have guaranteed things like privacy and those sorts of attributes to our customers. And that's what will be lost if we are not here. I think that's it. Okay, David is next. You can take the mic.
No, but I don't want to take the timer.
I'll keep the timer.
Okay, so I feel like a fish out of water here, I must be honest with you. I put together I'm an old friend of Bruce's, and I woke up one morning and he asked me to come. But I've known him for a long time, and I come from a very different place, which is more the entertainment industry and sort of technology and entertainment world. So I this is a very different orientation. So I don't, I know I'm familiar with much of the stuff you guys have been talking about because I read about it and I try to keep up with it, but it's really not my sort of day-to-day bread and butter kind of issues. What I'm finding, and this is, since I only have 5 minutes, what's to me is fascinating, and this was from Cisco, so there may be questionable, is where we are today is a world in which on internet traffic about 30%, and like in 5 years or less, they think it's going to be up to 68%. And what I'm finding is that as this enormous expansion of the content, the nature of the content, from more just simply data or voice or VoIP or whatever, moves to video-driven, this is occurring within a kind of a, this world which you guys have laid out quite well, which is this duopoly between the cable operators on one side and the phone companies on the other, which are basically all wanting to get in each other's businesses to basically control what the pipes, and ultimately, I believe, they're going to back end into the content itself in terms of controlling it. Where I would just argue to take Mark's point one step further, to me these changes are really part of repositioning of capital in the United States that's been going on for the last 25 years and the way that they respond to competition. So America has four principal export global products. One is arms and weaponry. Two is agriculture. Three is, what did I write here? Three is finance, of course, and we can see the consequences of that. And fourth, and perhaps where it concerns me, is intellectual property, the core of which is entertainment. And that's music, content, and video, television, all that kind of stuff. So the push to drive these industries is really part of the restructuring of the global marketplace and how I believe that with Reagan, but mostly later with the 96 Act, etc., they really signaled the restructuring of the United States as a global controller of those four primary sort of commodity-based activities. Where we are, where this goes, though, is that the United States is essentially losing as we move to this through this process. And much of these conversations so far have really pointed out the limitations, and we're living through it in terms of finance capital. What's fascinating to me in working in these industries is the way that the video content has been transformed as we've moved away from the PC screen now to the TV and more into handheld devices, cell phones, etc. What I find is two things have really taken over. One is that the nature of the content itself has been reshaped. And when it starts to look at the evolution of how, for example, the things I'm most familiar with is film, how the film is shot. I mean, if you go and look at what happened with the early sort of cinema, how it matured during the 40s and the 50s, the introduction of television restructures the way people, directors, and cameramen shoot films. This gets changed again with video, but more so it's actually being restructured again with the move toward handheld devices. And the two critical things when you go and see a movie, look for two things: the rate and the speed by which films or TV shows or commercials are edited, the speed of the way, and the role of the close-up. And the what used to be called the establishment shot is disappearing, a big wide-angle shot. These things are going away. So our very aesthetics are changed by these very processes that we take for granted. Again, I don't know anybody in this room except for Bruce. The way that most of us take for granted the very world we live in and how we communicate with each other. What's interesting, though, within this thing, is that in the process of the sort of the shift, the Moore's Law world, the shift to digital technologies, is that we're seeing an incredibly rich content developing, all kinds of stuff. And again, we saw some YouTube stuff before, but everything, you know, is becoming accessed through this explosive growth of web-based communications and wireless-based communications of video content. Tiny, you know, still images, short-form videos to feature films that can be distributed through streaming and downloads. What's interesting within this world of content, and one thing that I want to bring your attention to because I think it's going to become a great issue for the phone companies in particular, under Obama, and it's going to be his real First Amendment challenge, is something called sexting. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's the kids in this country, about 20-25% of teenagers in the United States, use their cell phones for flirting. And this flirting is very different from what you guys, or perhaps my kids did, which is they take nude or semi-nude pictures of each other and send it back and forth. And these kids are being arrested all over the country, and they were talking 13, 14 through 16, 17, 18-year-old kids, and they're being arrested and prosecuted for violation of child pornography laws. And what's good...
Not allowed to make pornography?
No. Well, that's a different question. Maybe we can raise that over a beer and talk about it. But I got one chart to go, and I'll get there. But it's going to be an interesting case because it... And I think the compared to the Bush administration, the guys at the Justice Department are actually much more positive about two things. One is age of consent requirements and the way they interpret the laws, and two, what the nature of the content is. The courts have really been stymied over the change in terms of how to apply the obscenity laws, and with the social networking phenomenon, Web 2.0, it's going to be very interesting how they come to terms with this particular one issue of what I, you know, this, it's called sexting. But I bring it up because, again, we go to the, here's my last issue. What are the real issues that we have to deal with? One is, I'm saying is, and we've had some good discussions of this, we haven't, the word Internet Protocol, IPTV, is the battle cry in which the phone companies and the cable operators are attempting to create, you know, instead of the open network, they're looking very hard to create the two-tier highway. And the Obama has been strong, and the Congress has been very good, and the new head of the FCC has been very good about preserving net neutrality. The argument that I wish we talk about is, and I guess it's at the core of this whole meeting, is can you take the principles of net neutrality and sort of push them down a level? So it's not about content freedom, what you distribute, but really the infrastructure itself as a form of, can you take common carriage and apply it at the infrastructure at the very basic level so that essentially the regulatory debate turns not about the number of providers, because it could be one or it could be 100, but how they provide and let anything be carried on their network. Finally, the last point to me is really what the impact of the internet is having on the media in general. I mean, we saw on one extreme, with the music industry freaked out over free access to, and it's restructured, and we know through downloads, etc., the entire music industry has been changed. The newspaper business is going through a fundamental, irrevocable crisis where it will become something quite different than it has been for the last 100 years. The film industry, which is what I spent a lot of time with, is really going, not knowing how to figure out where, how it comes through this process. The consolidation into these five or six major sort of media conglomerates which control most of the kind of intellectual content of at least in entertainment are all facing a similar sort of crisis of how they're going to work through. And the vehicle, to the extent that we kept open, we go back to this competition issue, is the internet, because it's a disintermediating technology that essentially breaks their control in many ways. So that's my little talk for today. And again, I don't know how much I share with you guys because a lot of it's going right by me. But I appreciate the opportunity to be here. And actually, you got to remember, at the end of the day, it's the people who are creating the content that really drive it and make this stuff usable and appealing to the population at large. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Thanks very much. My name is Carl Mayer, the Mayer Law Group. We're a class action consumer firm. We brought the first lawsuit against the Bush administration, the NSA, and Verizon for their dragnet surveillance and wiretapping of Americans back in 2006. The lawsuit was filed in May of 2006. It's still being fought out in federal courts across the country. Actually, I wanted just a housekeeping thing. I haven't we haven't really, I think, adequately thanked Bruce Kushnick and Joe Plotkin for organizing the event and getting everything underway. It's really the dedication of small business people, consumer advocates, etc., that I think is going to change some of the power imbalances that the phone companies exert in this country. I have two very quick charges. The first is to discuss the state of privacy in the United States, and the second is to update you on the litigation against the phone companies, all in 5 minutes. So, the state of privacy is not a healthy one. The former chair of Sun Microsystems, Scott McNeely, was quoted several years ago as saying, privacy is dead, get over it. And that is sort of the large corporate view of what privacy should be and is in the United States at this juncture. Fortunately, there have been some citizen counter-reactions to that viewpoint. Our lawsuit is one of them. Since we're past the halfway point, I'll also, many of you might have seen this video, but this is a sort of entertaining, satiric description of how the federal government it conducts their privacy affairs. So let me see if I can get this to work. I'm probably the least technological person here. Do you hear this? This is Zimmerman, who is a satirist. I do some radio shows in California, and every time I'm on, they play this song. Essentially, what he is satirizing is what has been described as the established policy of the Bush administration after 9/11 to use the foreign intelligence agencies to monitor the calling patterns and calling records of all phone company subscribers. We actually, in our case, developed an affidavit from an AT&T whistleblower who averred that actually this policy of collecting calling patterns and information on customers had been occurring prior to 9/11, and that, in fact, AT&T had launched something called Project Groundbreaker, which was to actually replicate AT&T's hub system in Bernardsville, New Jersey, which actually tracks all of the calls of citizens in the United States, to replicate that for the NSA down in Washington, D.C. In any event, there's my cue. In any event, the status of the case is the following. We fortunately, after we filed and a couple of other plaintiffs filed, there are about 50 law firms working on this litigation across the country. It's all been put in a multi-district litigation panel before Judge Vaughn Walker in California. Now, he's a fairly conservative Republican judge. Walker, as in Herbert Walker Bush, he's actually related to the Bush family. Nonetheless, the government's arguments for using the foreign intelligence agencies to monitor the activities of domestic citizens have not sat well with this judge. The judge has essentially rejected every one of the government's argument and the phone company's arguments. Essentially, the government has been trying to blanket this case in what they call the state secrets doctrine, which they take to mean that no litigation of this type can go forward, because to go forward, the very nature of it would disclose state secrets or government secrets. And that doctrine has been rejected, fortunately, by Judge Walker as recently as 5 days ago in a related case called Al Haramain. And that probably will make its way up to the Supreme Court very quickly on an emergent basis. In the interim, the phone companies got busy with their lobbyists, went to Washington, and they passed just before Bush administration left office, they passed a piece of legislation that immunizes both retroactively and prospectively the phone companies from liability under this. Even though the phone companies should have enormous liability, because under the Telecommunications Act and various amendments passed subsequent to that, every time you turn over a phone record to the government of a subscriber, you're subject under the statute to a $1,000 penalty. That's actually per incident. So it's a multi-billion dollar lawsuit, but neither the Congress nor the phone companies were going to tolerate that, so they passed this immunity bill. We've now come back and have challenged the constitutionality of that legislation, on not just on separation of powers grounds, but also on takings grounds. We have some other arguments as well. And that's where the litigation stands. I'm a bit over my time. I would only conclude by saying that what you're doing in convening a gathering to challenge the monopoly power and the dominant power of the phone companies is a very important one to sort of tie things together. In this recession, I think what we're seeing is that for the last 15, 20 years, these companies have been engaged in domestic spying, exerting monopoly power, overbilling, fleecing of consumers. They've been engaged in all of the type of activities, lobbying in Washington, all of the type of activities that doesn't add to the bottom line of the nation, that doesn't increase productivity, but rather enhances their institutional prerogatives to the detriment of the country. And so I'd close with Benjamin Franklin's observation, which he said it a little differently, but is attributed to him in what he said was that those who would sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither. That is certainly the case here. And unless we continue to fight this, I think it will detract from the security and liberty of the nation. So we will continue to do so. I appreciate your time. Are there any burning questions, or can we go right to the third panel?
Quick one, go ahead.
This is an open-ended question to anybody who wants to take it up. What is the potential for peer-to-peer mesh networking and better, higher bandwidth wireless to circumvent the problems of the
I think Dane will be addressing that on the third
panel. We can talk about it, but I'm going to talk about a little bit of that in the third panel.
For John, you mentioned that the FCC is now coming down on the Verizons and Comcast of the world are left to be unregulated on the pipes, but that the application providers are starting to be scrutinized more by the federal government. What were you talking about?
So there was a series of decisions since about 2004 that the FCC has embarked upon. The first was deregulating the cable modem, not imposing common carrier regulations on cable modems. Then not imposing common carrier regulations on the DSL pipe. Then not imposing common carrier regulations on wireless broadband. Then not imposing on the broadband over power line. So there's no common carrier regulation on the access pipe. But in the series of VoIP regulations over the past 3 years or so, the FCC has started to impose what were historically common carrier regulations imposed upon telephony providers upon the internet voice providers. So you see
people like that?
Well, even more so. Yeah, well, right now, the way the rules apply, they apply to anyone that's called an interconnected VoIP provider. So if you are a VoIP provider and happen to even tangentially connect to the public switched telephone network, you are subject to the Title II common carrier-like regulations that were historically imposed upon the phone company. Although the phone company, to the extent they're now offering those services over broadband pipes, are no longer regulated.
Yeah. Which causes tremendous tax problems for the independent VoIP, people switching VoIP. One of my clients does 400 million minutes a month on Vonage, and they're subject to taxation that AT&T is not, for doing the exact same service. So the government is in cahoots with the large ones to kill competition, and that's a real crime in a free country.
You've said the last question.
Is that mic working?
Okay, this is a question for Mark and Jonathan, and I think in an interesting way for Dave personally too. How much have you thought about corporate accountability? This is an issue I've seen coming up on the left and the right, especially in the previous administration, facing a big problem. Basically, even when you pass a law, it doesn't even get involved. Whether in the form of being specific about the Commerce Clause interpretation in your law, okay, or a new Judiciary Act, or some other form of holding limited liability entities accountable, just making it clear that that's actually something that we can do. This overcome judiciary arbitrariness, which is a big problem. And you know, this could also be deferred to the end of the last panel too, that does address that too. I just wanted to point it out at Mark and Jonathan and Dave.
I mean, I think it depends on the context. And a lot of the contexts I deal with, frankly, I would say that the phone companies and the cable companies would be breaching their fiduciary obligations to their shareholders if they did what I wanted them to do. This is why it's important for the regulators to actually exist and tell the phone companies and the cable companies that they must adhere to competitive principles, that they must open up access to internet providers and would-be competitors. Because, frankly, I can't blame the phone companies for the failure of the regulators to compel them to open up their pipes to competitors. They are only doing what I think is in their corporate, what they are obligated to the shareholders to do, which means fighting tooth and nail up to the point where you're actually violating the law to make sure that no competitors can actually compete and cut in onto your into your revenue stream. So most of those issues, I think we've got a problem, and the problem must be answered by a vigilant regulator. Now on other issues, like I don't know if you're talking about the FISA wire, you know, and AT&T compliance with NSA rules or violation of consumer proprietary information, things like that. I would say to the extent that they've run afoul of their obligations pursuant to the Act, or pursuant to the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, then I think the corporate officers quite likely should be held accountable. Although if you look at it in the context of FISA, I'm not sure this is a path we're going down. But the one area where I had problems with Obama was when he seemed to have backtracked on the FISA rule. He seemed to have caved. He thought he was brokering a decent compromise. But that's the one area where I thought, oh my God, Obama, who I always thought was a policy about politics, had finally caved to political realities and gave in on a civil liberties issue that I thought was crucial. But the bottom line is, I don't see how anyone would have ever beaten the phone companies in a challenge pursuant to FISA. You know, to sue a phone company and say, you violated our civil liberties and you didn't abide by proper Fourth Amendment search and seizure principles, all they have to do is come around and say, the government told us to do it. I can't think of a jury in the country that's going to find a phone company liable for having done what the government actually told them to do.
Right. You want to get a word
quick, if I have to take on a corporation, I don't need a microphone. If I have to take on corporations, I'm going to swing for the fences. I need to go for corporate personhood.
Right.
We made a tremendous mistake. It's 125 years old.
Yeah.
It was a side decision in a shitty case, right? And we've let it grow into a monster. We never intended corporations to have these rights and be these beings, and so if I'm going to fight with corporations, I want to take away their personhood. That changes the whole status of corporations.
I
know.
But a lot of the progression and the deterioration associated with that, subsequent to that, has occurred through very arbitrary decisions on the Supreme Court part about what the common cause means when they don't say anything. Okay? So that's the problem.
That's a good point.
Let's come back to the...